the schoolman, whose method has left its stamp upon all subsequent Catholic apologetics, distinguished five avenues of approach by which we infer, from the conditions of our outward experience, the existence of a God. I, in all motion, or rather, as we should say, in all change, you can separate two elements, active and passive, that which is changed, and that which changes it, but, in our experience, the agent in such change is not self-determined, but determined in its turn by some higher agent. Can this process go on ad infinitum? No, for an infinite series of agents, none of them self-determined, would not give us the finality which thought demands. There must be, at the beginning of the series, however long, an agent, who is self-determined, who is the ultimate agent, in the whole cycle of changes, that proceeds from him. 2. Period. Similarly, in our experience every event is determined by a cause, but that cause in its turn is itself an event determined by a cause. An infinite series of causes would give no explanation of how the causation ever began. There must therefore be an uncaused cause, which is the ultimate cause of the whole nexus of events which proceeds from it. 3. In our experience, we find nothing which exists in its own right, everything depends for its existence on something else. This is plain in the case of the organized individual, for plants, animals, etc., are born, live, and die. That is to say, their existence is only contingent, not necessary, it depends on conditions outside itself. Now, although the whole sum of matter does not, in our experience, increase or diminish, we cannot think of it as existing necessarily, it is just there. Its existence, then, must depend on something outside itself, something which exists necessarily, of its own right, that something we call God. 4. In our experience, there are various degrees of natural perfection, but the existence of the good and the better implies the existence of a best, for according to Plato's system of thought, this best is itself the cause and the explanation of all good, but this best is not found in our earthly experience. Therefore it must be beyond our earthly experience, and it is this best which we call God. 5. Everywhere in nature we observe the effects of order and system. If blind chance ruled everything, this prevalence of order would be inexplicable, it would be a stupendous coincidence. Order can only be conceived as the expression of a mind, and, though our mind appreciates the existence of order in the world, it is not our mind which has introduced it there. There must therefore exist outside our experience a mind, of which this order is the expression, and that mind we call God. It is often objected that this analysis of the facts is unnecessarily itemized, it repeats the same argument, under different forms. For the purposes of the plain man, it may perhaps be admitted that the first three of these arguments are not readily distinguishable. He apprehends God in his creation, first, as all-powerful, and the source of all power I2, and 3, then, as all-good, and the source of all goodness 4, then, as all-wise, and the source of all wisdom 5. For all the changes that have swept over Europe since the 12th century, he has not been bullied out of his conviction. It is true, the little books of popular science which he reads in his comer of the railway train talk as if all this process of thought were antiquated, as if something had happened in the meantime which made creation self-explanatory without the postulate of a creator. Their cocksure implications affect him, like briars that flick a man across the face without turning him aside from his direction. They tell him that matter is indestructible, not elucidating their meaning, which is that man is incapable of destroying it, but even so he will not believe that matter has existed, for no particular reason, from all eternity, or that, stranger still, it brought itself into existence. They write of force with a capital F, or energy, with a capital E, as if we had somehow managed to deify those conceptions. But he knows that whereas motion is a fact that can be observed, force is a concept with which he is only acquainted through his experience. As a living creature, it is a function of life, and the forces of nature, as they are called, over which neither man nor beast exercises any control, must be functions of a life which is outside experience itself. They write, as if science had made the problem of existence simpler by explaining the causes of things hitherto unexplained by showing us that disease is due to the action of microbes, or that lightning comes from the electricity in the atmosphere. But he knows that all this only puts the question a stage further back, that he is still at liberty to ask what caused the microbes, what caused the electricity. The thought of an infinite series, whether of causes or of agents, is no more attractive to him than to Saint Thomas. Of course, it is possible to avoid all these speculations with a bovine murmur of, "I don't know nothing about that," but this is to give up the riddle. And to give it up, not because you cannot find the answer, but because you have found the answer, and have found it to be unpalatable. The lines of our experience, even in the natural world outside us, converge towards one point: presuppose a creator, who has necessary existence, a prime mover, a first cause. But the created universe points to the existence not merely of an uncreated power, but of an uncreated mind. This argument from the order and systems to be found in creation is not synonymous with the argument from design. The argument from design, in the narrow sense, is a department or application of the main thesis. Design implies the adaptation of means to ends, and it used to be confidently urged that there was one end which the Creator clearly had in view, the preservation of species, and one plain proof of his purposive working, namely, the nice proportion between the instincts or endowments of the various animal species, and the environment in which they had to live, the warm coats of the Arctic animals, the differences of strength, speed, and cunning which enable the hunter and the hunted to live together without the extermination of either. These would be instances in point. Modern researches have given us still more salient instances of the same principle, such as the protective mimicry which renders a butterfly or a nest of eggs indistinguishable from its surroundings. Was it not a mind which had so proportioned means to ends? The argument was a dangerous one, so stated. It took no account of the animal species which have in fact become extinct. It presupposed, also, the fixity of animal types. God's mercy, doubtless, is over all his works, but we are in no position to apply teleological criticism to its exercise, and to decide on what principle the warthog has survived while the dodo has become extinct. In this precise form, then, the argument from order has suffered badly. But the argument from order, as the schoolmen conceived it, was, and is, a much wider and less questionable consideration. It is not merely in the adaptation of means to ends, but in the reign of law throughout the whole field of nature, that we find evidence of a creative intelligence. By a curious trick of human vanity, we describe a newly discovered principle in nature as so, and so's law, Boyle's, or Newton's, or Tyndall's, as if the discoverer were himself the legislator. I am not grudging honor to the pioneers of research, I am only commenting on an oddity of phrase. Surely, when a thing is unexpectedly found, we congratulate the person who has found it, but our next question is inevitably, who put it there? And, if there are laws in nature to be discovered, it is but natural to ask the same question: who put them there? If it needs a mind to discover them, did it not need a mind to devise them? If the whole of our experience is not a phantasmagoria of unrelated facts, if water does not flow uphill, and gases do not double in volume when the pressure on them is doubled, who was it willed that the thing should be so? Not we, assuredly. Not Boyle, not Newton, not blind chance, for there is a limit to coincidence. Not nature, for there is no such person, she is only an abstraction. What hypothesis is left to us except that of an ordering mind? Instinctively we speak of a law, when we find a natural principle, and have we no right to argue from a law to a legislator? I know that to superior persons all this will sound very naive, but it is easy to suspect simplicity in your opponent's mind, when the simplicity really lies in the facts. There are thoughts so obvious that we are apt not to reflect upon them, so familiar that we are in danger of forgetting them. So far we have been dealing with the evidences for God's existence which are concerned with outward nature, not with the inner life of man. The argument from perfection adduced by the schoolmen is not the modern argument from moral perfection. The plain man would probably conceive the relations between God and man, in the moral sphere, with more of directness, more of concreteness. He would tell us that the voice of conscience was a voice not his own. Whose then can it be, if it be not divine? Or he would tell us, in Kant's vein, that the sense of moral duty is the sense of an obligation imposed upon us by a sovereignty outside ourselves. Whose sovereignty, if not God's? Or he would tell us that the sense of compunction which he feels when he has done wrong is not to be explained away as mere disappointment with himself. It carries with it the sense that he has defied a power above himself, whose power, if it be not God's, to each his own appeal. There is little need to dwell on this side of the argument, for probably everyone who has the least hankerings after theism feels the force of it in one form or another. Otherwise I would ask space to argue that the scholastic form of it has a special value, as the truest both to the philosophic and to the devotional instinct. I have made no attempt in this chapter to deal with the objections which will present themselves to minds influenced by the more intimate doubts of idealism. I have been forced to assume what the schoolmen assumed, and most ordinary people assume, that our thought is an instrument adequate to the cognition of objective reality. Still less have I attempted to anticipate the rejoiners of the pragmatist, who, it seems to me, above all men should wish to be a Catholic, and above all men will find it difficult to become one. I have merely indicated the course which Catholic apologetic takes in this fundamental matter, trusting that the inquirer, if his doubts begin so early in the process, will find access to more lucid and more copious expositions than mine. 5. The Catholic Notion of God. If the arguments adduced in the foregoing chapter are valid, they commit us not only to a belief in the existence of God, but to certain views as to his nature. I do not mean to discuss or even enumerate here, as a textbook of theology would, the various attributes of God, for fear of unduly crowding the canvas. It is enough for our present purposes to insist that the God who is postulated by a consideration of his works and nature must be a transcendent God, an omnipotent God, and a personal God. The very nerve of our contention is that the material world which meets us in our experience does not provide the explanation of its own existence, or of the forces which control it, or of the laws which govern it, that the explanation, consequently, must be looked for in something that is outside and beyond itself. Our thought can only be satisfied by the existence of some necessary being, to which all this contingent existence around us, the world of creation, is secondary, and upon which it depends. Upon which, or rather, upon whom? We must always explain the lower in terms of the higher, not the higher in terms of the lower. And the highest form of existence of which we have any experience is spirit. Man finds himself possessed of this apparently unique privilege, that he can become the object of his own thought. He can focus his attention, not merely upon things outside himself, but upon himself the thinker, upon himself thinking. Adam must have had many strange experiences when he woke in paradise, but none stranger than that of meeting himself. The difference between this self-consciousness and mere consciousness is as real, as vital, as the difference between consciousness itself and mere life, or the difference between life and mere existence. This spiritual principle, this self-conscious life within man, is not accounted for, still less explained, by his needs, as a mere citizen of the natural creation. It is something altogether outside the scheme of ordinary organic life. It exists for its own sake, and must therefore be regarded as a higher order of existence. It is to this higher order of existence, naturally, that he refers that highest of all possible existences which he calls by the name of God. It has been a favorite taunt of the unbeliever, from Xenophanes down to Rupert Brooke, that, if horses had conceived of theology, they would have imagined God. Like themselves, if fishes had invented a theology, they would have imagined God. Like themselves, the criticism is one of those which miss the mark so completely as to provide their own refutation. For the fact is that man is superior to horses and fishes in one point, namely, his self-consciousness, his spiritual life, and it is precisely in virtue of that spiritual quality, and of that alone, that he has dared to conceive of God as like to himself. He conceives of God not as a big man, but as a great spirit, lacking precisely those features of inferiority which link man, in his dual nature, to the brutes. Man's soul, which in memory, in intellect, and in will stands outside of and superior to the accidents of his mortality, is the only mirror he finds in nature, of that pure act, that tireless energy which is God. And if God be spirit, then he is a personal God. For all our experience of spirit, all our evidence for its existence, rests upon the first-hand consciousness which each man has of himself, and second-hand indications which point to the existence of a similar consciousness in his neighbor. Each spirit, as it is given to us in our experience, is a lonely point of conscious existence. Matter, as we know it, may enter into various combinations and assume various forms. We do not meet with spirit, we only meet with spirits, and the notion that God is not a spirit, but the totality of existing spirits, and nothing more, the notion that he is spirit, and not a spirit, is pure mythology. It overlooks that individuality, that incommunicableness, which belongs to all spirits in our experience. It is not suggested, of course, that the being who created us is subject to all the limitations which our minds may happen to associate with the word personality, but, in thinking of God as a spirit, we cannot rule out the idea of conscious individuality, for that idea is essential to our whole conception of a spiritual nature. We must not conceal from ourselves the fact that in so defining the nature of God as transcendent, omnipotent, and personal, we have parted company with a great number of the more religiously affected of mankind. We have said nothing, so far, which could not be echoed by a Jew, or by a Mohammedan. But we have quarreled, already, with that pantheistic conception of the divine being which has had such a profound influence on other religions of the East. The vice of pantheism is that its theology takes life, not spirit, as its point of departure. Dichotomizing the world wrongly into matter and life, the pantheist assumes that the animal organism is the mirror of the universe. As, in the animal, matter finds a principle of life to organize it, so the whole sum of matter in existence must have a life to organize it, a life which is the summing up of all the life vegetable or animal which exists. This life is God. God is to the world what the soul in the widest sense is to the body. Thus, on the one hand, the pantheist theology contrives to give an explanation of existence which is no explanation at all, for the totality of our experience plus a world soul does not, by reason of the addition, provide any account of how or why it came into existence, and on the other hand it encumbers our thought with the concept of a God, who is no God, who is, indeed, but an abstraction. As animal life divorced from matter is an abstraction, who can neither affect our destinies, nor prescribe our conduct, nor claim our worship, impotent, unmoral, and only demanding by courtesy the typographical complement of a capital G. So sharply is the God whom we Catholics worship, we Catholics, with the Jews and the Mohammedans divided from the notion of deity which has syncretized, spiritualized, or superseded the many-headed monsters of the pagan East. Is the God of modern Protestantism so clearly marked off from his Oriental counterpart? I confess that I entertain acute and growing misgivings on this point. The tendency of Protestantism, as I suggested in the last chapter, is to find its evidence of God's existence rather in some supposed instinct or intuition, than in any inference from premises grounded in experience. But such methods of proof, even granted their validity, would only warrant us in accepting the fact of his existence, without telling us anything about his nature. Most men believe in God. Yes, but then a very large percentage of them are pantheists, of one shade or another. The common belief of mankind does not, then, proclaim the existence of a deity, who is transcendent. There is in man's nature an itch for worship, an instinct for religion. Yes, but what sort of religion? Why should not Buddhism, for example, satisfy the craving? Mystics have had direct experience of God's presence. It behoves us, then, to trust their experience rather than our own earthbound imaginations. Yes, but which mystics? The Christian or the Buddhist mystics? Unless we are prepared to fall back on the doctrine of Descartes and Berkeley, who would make God immediately responsible for those ideas through which alone we come in contact with any outside reality, it seems to me that all direct proofs of God's existence yield only a blank formula, which we have no intellectual apparatus for filling in. What kind of God, then, does Protestantism mean to propose for our worship? Our idealist philosophers, still mournfully chewing the cud of Hegelianism, have no assurance to offer, either that God is omnipotent, or in what sense he is personal. There remains only the moral argument, to distinguish Protestantism in its more adventurous forms from the cruder forms of pantheism. Doubtless it will always be held, at least in the Western Hemisphere, that the Supreme Being, however conceived, must be the summing up of all those aspirations towards goodness which our own moral experience teaches us to indulge. But is such a God necessarily the judge of living and dead? Is it permissible to pray to him, in the sense of asking for favors which he can grant? Has he the attributes of the God, whom Jesus of Nazareth preached, and claimed, apparently, to reveal? Surely it is time that Protestant theologians should consider seriously the very fundamentals of their thought, and this question not least: what do we know of God's nature, and on what basis of thought does that knowledge rest? For in this matter the ideas of their half-hearted supporters are lamentably incoherent, and such hesitation may easily lend a handle, before long, to the propaganda of theosophy. The doctrine of God's omnipotence carries with it a further admission which will be of considerable importance, in succeeding chapters I mean, the permanent possibility of miracle. If the laws of the natural creation are not an expression of God's nature, as the pantheist would hold, but merely of his will, it follows that he is at liberty, if he will, to suspend their action, or rather, to supersede their action by that of higher laws which have not been made known to us. It is only reasonable, would that it were as common, as it is reasonable to have a clear notion as to the possibility of miracles happening, before we come to estimate the evidence, debatable in itself as all historical evidence must be, which claims that miracles have actually occurred in history. A century and a half ago, it would have been necessary to investigate carefully, in this connection, the philosophic system known as deism. It was but natural that the triumphs of mechanical science in the 18th century should impose on men's minds the idea of mechanism. It was but natural that the Christian apologetic of the period should reflect this idea in its turn. Deism asserts strongly the first two scholastic proofs of God's existence, while neglecting the third. If we think of God merely as the first cause and the prime mover, it is not necessary to think of him as influencing the course of the natural creation here and now. You may think of him, instead, at some moment in the infinitely remote past, fashioning a world, giving it laws, physical and biological, to guide its movements, and then turning it adrift, like a ship with its tiller lashed, to reach its inevitable and foreseen destiny. Paley's metaphor of the watch once for all wound up is, of course, the classic illustration of this deist conception. It represents God as having made the universe, but not as guiding it from moment to moment, still less as actually holding it in being. Such a system was considerably embarrassed to find room for the possibility of miracle. To intrude miracle upon cosmos so governed would have been to put a spoke in the wheels of the machine, with consequences fatally disturbing to the scheme of the whole. Deism, nowadays, is cited only as a vagary of the past. It has few, if any, living supporters. It is hardly necessary, then, to remind the reader that laws do not carry themselves out. They are principles which need an executive to enforce them, and to conceive the laws of nature as acting on their own initiative, independently of God's concurrence, is to personify those laws, if not actually to deify them. The Catholic notion of God's relation to the universe is summed up once for all in our Lord's statement, that no sparrow can fall to the ground without our Heavenly Father. There can be no event, however insignificant, however apparently fortuitous, however cruel in its bearing on the individual, which does not demand, here and now, the concurrence of the divine power. I do not mean that Catholic thought bases this belief on our Lord's utterance. It belongs to natural, not to revealed theology. God alone exists necessarily. Our existence is contingent, depends, that is to say, from moment to moment upon an exercise of His will. He has not left the reins, He has not lashed the tiller, He works not by means of the laws, but only according to the laws which He has laid down for Himself in determining the governance of His creatures. It will easily be seen that, once this view of the divine economy is grasped, there can be no further talk of ruling out miracles on the ground of impossibility. It is still open to the objector to say that it would be inconsistent with our idea of God's dignity to imagine Him as interfering with His own laws, or that it would be a criticism on those laws themselves to suppose they could ever need to be suspended in favor of an individual need. Such objections we shall have to meet later. For the present, it is enough to point out that miracles, so far as their possibility is concerned, do fit into the scheme of things. Indeed, to describe God as Almighty is to admit that miracles are possible. The difficulty, it may even be said, for our human imaginations is to understand the fall of the sparrow rather than to understand the feeding of the 5,000. For in the fall of the sparrow, as in the feeding of the multitude, the divine power is at work. Only in this case the concurrence of God, as the primary cause, with those secondary causes, which we are apt to imagine as complete in themselves, is a thing as baffling to the imagination as it is necessary to thought. We have been considering only the first article of the creed which Catholics and Protestants alike recognize. I believe in God the Father Almighty. It will be seen that the outline of the Catholic system is already beginning to take shape on the canvas. It begins already to stand out in relief, not only as against the pantheistic religions of the East, never attractive to our fellow countrymen, but against much vagueness and indecision which is to be read or to be suspected in non-Catholic works of theology. It is not that Protestantism, in its official formularies, finds or has ever found cause of disagreement with us in such fundamental matters as these, but I shall be very much surprised if the arguments which I have adduced, and the conclusions I have inferred from them, in this and the preceding chapter, do not cause some of my clerical critics to hold up their hands already at the intransigence, the medievalism of the thought which is here represented. The Catholic notion of God ought not to be distinct from the Protestant notion of God, but I fear that in practice a shadow of difference is already discernible between them. If this is so, it must be attributed, first, to the departmentalism, the absence of system, which reigns among non-Catholic theologians, partly to the spirit of unauthorized adventure which makes them start out gaily in pursuit of some novel thesis, partly to the extreme incuriosity with which the average worshipper regards all details of doctrine. I wish I could think that my estimate of the situation was exaggerated, and my forebodings of the future a scruple. 6. THEC Ground OF Revelation. It would be wholly preposterous to approach the next stage in the argument for Catholicism, I mean the emergence of the Christian revelation, without paying some attention to the providential history, so we reckon it, of the Jewish people. Circumstances have not been wanting to bring Judaism and Christendom into conflict, and the scars of that conflict remain. But Judaism and Catholicism have subtle qualities in common, and I fancy that a Jewish convert enters the Church more naturally and more simply than a Protestant would. He has less of prejudice and of scruple to live down, his new beliefs are a continuation rather than a correction of the old. And small wonder, for the foundation upon which Christian thought is based is not mere theism, but theism cast in a particular mold by the influence of Jewish thought. We must not, of course, at this stage in the proceedings, talk of Old Testament literature as if it possessed any quality of inspiration in the ecclesiastical sense of the term. That admission will be made much later on, for it is an admission which we accept only on the authority of the Church. For the present, we must accord to the Old Testament only that relative and guarded confidence which we should accord to Herodotus, or to Livy, nor do I propose to write here as if any certainty had yet been attained, as to the dates at which the various Old Testament books were compiled. A century of irresponsible criticism, conducted on both sides of the North Sea, by a handful of confident scholars, has reached various conclusions on this point which will quite certainly have to be revised before long. It has been their favorite doctrine that most of the Pentateuch, instead of dating from Moses, comes down to us from the time of the Babylonian captivity, that is not much older than 500 BC. Yet the Samaritans, whose traditions are certainly pre-exilic, hold the Pentateuch in no less reverence than their Jewish rivals. In fact, we have to suppose that the forgers, who produced the Pentateuch, not only passed off their fraud upon the Jewish public, but actually secured recognition for it from the intensely hostile and intensely conservative population of Samaria. A layman may be pardoned for feeling that such criticism as this is pure mythology, but, in view of the uncertainties which are prevalent, I mean to give here some estimate of the Jewish religious standpoint as a whole, without distinguishing the various alleged strata in the deposit or claiming for the whole any very remote antiquity. It will be noticed that the Jews, actuated by what they consider to be a divine revelation, seem to have taken precisely that view of the divine nature which is, we have hitherto argued, the most rational view of it. They thought of God as an almighty, a transcendent, and a personal God. Poetry, and especially the poetry of nature, gravitates at all times towards pantheism, yet the Jewish writers, with the strongest possible appreciation of nature, at least in her wilder moods, never failed to argue back from the phenomena which they saw to the creative power which produced them. Heaven was God's throne, earth his footstool, the day and the night were his couriers. It was the voice of the Lord that made the hinds to bring forth young, and shook the cedars of Libanus. In the permanence of the everlasting hills, in the strength of Leviathan, in the lion roaring after his prey, or the birds nesting in the trees, Jewish poetry could read but one lesson, repeated almost to monotony, the greatness of the power to which all these effects were due. Their Palestinian neighbors were heathens who saw in the yearly process of sun, rain, harvest, and vintage the influence of occult spiritual influences. Yet the Jews never lost the sense, bred in them by their desert training, of a God infinitely remote, yet active in every fortune of man's life, and in every phase of his natural surroundings. It has, indeed, been suggested by critical historians that the religion of the Jews was at first monolatry, that is, the worship of a tribal god, specially concerned with the fortunes of his own people, and existing side by side with a number of other tribal gods, his rivals, that it only developed by gradual stages into monotheism, that is, belief in one god as the only god, with the accompanying conviction that tribal gods had no existence except in the imagination of their votaries. Of any such development there is little proof, except what can be derived from an ad hoc manipulation of the evidence. What does seem clear is that there was, at all times, a popular tendency to lose sight of God's uniqueness, and to accord him merely an honored place amidst a heathen pantheon, but that this popular tendency was at all times counteracted by a noble series of patriots, reformers, and prophets, under whose influence the religious instinct of Judaism was constantly reverting to type. The notion that monotheism was a private discovery of the prophet Amos in something like 800 BC will hardly commend itself to the impartial observer, who considers the intense obstinacy of the Jewish race and its eager retentiveness of tradition. As a condition of monotheism, the Jewish people had to be particularly on its guard against local worship and against pictorial representations of the divine influence. Rival local cults of the same god will breed, in time, a multiplicity of gods. Dissimilar representations of the same god will be rationalized, in time, into different conceptions of God, and so into the conception of different gods. The Protestant division of the Decalogue, which distinguishes the prohibition of polytheism from the prohibition of idolatry, as two separate commandments, is curiously untrue to the science, if it be a science, of comparative religion. Idolatry is at once the expression and the breeding ground of polytheism. Here again, if our documents are worth anything at all, the history of the Jewish people is not the history of a development away from idolatry towards a more spiritual form of worship. It is the history of a series of alternations and struggles, the baser popular instinct of the Jews always hankering after visible gods and local sanctuaries, their religious leaders rallying them continually always by an appeal to antiquity, and bringing them round again to the worship of that unique spirit whom the heaven of heavens cannot contain. Draw, for a moment, an imaginary line across the story of the past, forget all that has happened since the year 4 BC, rule out from your mind all the reverence with which centuries of Christianity have invested the Old Testament, all the prejudices which the accidents of later times have raised against the Jewish character as a factor in world history. Isolate in your mind the picture of a little people, assailed and half infected by all the superstitions of the ancient world, the animal worship of Egypt, the vegetation cults of the Canaanitish Aborigines, the astrology of Babylon, the cultured anthropomorphism of classical Greece, yet ever obstinately retaining, after a thousand half-surrenders and tentative apostasies, the conception of a single God, unique in His majesty, controlling the destinies of all nations and all the forces of the created universe. Is there not, in that picture, something infinitely noble, some quality of unexpectedness which almost demands a special divine revelation to account for it? Is it mere coincidence that amidst all the clash of empires around the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, unchanged by the influence of Egyptian, Hittite, Assyrian, Syrian, Chaldean, or Phoenician civilization, unconquered in its inmost hopes by the conquests of Osiris, an Alexander, or a Pompey, one tiny mountain people should have cherished like a sacred fire, its inviolable tradition of worship, should have upheld, to the unseeing eyes of pagan antiquity, a conception of fundamental theology which centuries of subsequent reflection have neither modified nor improved. It is a spectacle which already provokes us to thought, makes us wonder whether God Himself had not already, by means of some partial revelation, interfered to assist men's frantic guesses at His secret, and point their minds towards the truth. But it must be admitted that this distinctive tradition of worship is found side by side with a distinctive sense of nationality, religion, and politics went hand in hand. The Jew was not more convinced of God's uniqueness than of the unique position which belonged to his own race. They shall be my people, and I will be their God. No cult of a tribal fetish was ever more conscientiously national. God is the king over all the earth, yet it has pleased him to select one only out of all the nations of the earth, one people, whom he will honor with singular privileges and visit with singular chastisements because they are his people. In a unique sense, theirs is a covenanted position. Fidelity is demanded on both sides from them, to their national traditions, from God, to his promises of deliverance when deliverance is needed. The effect of this bilateral contract is a curious one. It engages Almighty God, who is, Exodus hypothesi, the Father of all mankind, to concern Himself with the fortunes of one particular race, to the exclusion, apparently, of all other races under heaven. The most inclusive of theologies is paradoxically maintained by the most exclusive of peoples. A monotheistic religion is commonly a missionary religion. It has no patience with the polytheism of its neighbors. It cannot, like monolatry, apply a live and let live principle to the multiplicity of surrounding cults. To this principle Judaism forms a curious exception. Proselytes, indeed, existed as an institution, and during the captivity a notion seems to emerge that the dispersion of the Jews is intended by Providence to disseminate monotheism in the world. Tob 13:1. But, in general, Jewish thought seems to recognize a habitual division of the world into the Jews and the godless Gentiles. The key to this anomaly lay in the remote future. Someday there would be a violent interference with the existing order of things. There would be a triumphant vindication of God and of His people. A kingdom would be set up which should mirror on earth the perfect justice of heaven. It is not only the scriptural authors who assure us of this attitude of expectancy, the extra-biblical literature which is known as apocalyptic or eschatological proves its popularity right down to the time of the Christian dispensation. It looks as if the prophecy of Daniel, the most distinctively apocalyptic of the Old Testament scriptures, had produced a crop of imitations. The Book of Enoch, and all the rest of them, these anticipations do not by any means agree in matters of detail. Sometimes we hear, sometimes we do not hear, of a personal victor who is to usher in this kingdom. Sometimes we might suppose him to be a man. Sometimes he is clearly conceived as more than human. He is to come on the clouds of heaven. Sometimes the Gentiles are to be crushed under the yoke of the conqueror. Sometimes they are to live peaceably under his kingdom. Sometimes a resurrection of the dead is to precede. Sometimes it is to follow the kingdom itself. But whatever the details, it seems clear that the Jews cherished a continual and a growing hope of final deliverance, that in the most disastrous times of their history, this hope did but grow the stronger, and that at the time of Christ's birth, at least among those faithful souls who waited for the consolation of Israel, the fulfillment of all these prophecies was awaited with eager expectancy, perhaps through some mathematical calculations from the Book of Daniel. Perhaps only because the events of the first century B.C. had given the death blow to any idea of a merely political emancipation. Thus the nation which had so curiously preserved, amidst a world of fantastic mythologies, a rational and a dignified conception of the divine nature, was also unlike other nations, in this that it looked always to the future for the justification of its own existence. The Jew was proud of his national history. None more so, but he felt that the whole of this process was only the prelude to a mysterious deliverance in the future, a deliverance for which no political considerations gave him any ground for hope. The Jewish race walks backwards through history, its eyes turned towards the future, as one who heralds the coming of a king. It is as if the God whose nature they had divined had determined to give the world a still fuller revelation of himself, and had chosen first Abraham from his kindred, then Jacob from among his descendants, then Judah from among all the posterity of Jacob, had preserved this people of his from so many perils of conquest, and had ransomed them from two captivities, only as the preparation for some destiny hitherto unforeshadowed. The moment at which John the Baptist's preaching found so ready an echo in the hearts of his fellow countrymen was the worst possible moment for a successful Jewish insurrection. It would have had to encounter not the undisciplined armies of some Asiatic tyrant, but the grim, relentless pressure of the Roman legions. On the other hand, it was the moment, humanly speaking, for a successful missionary campaign in favor of some new propaganda. Within the last 300 years, the conquests of Alexander had spread, up to the very gates of India, a uniform veneer of Greek culture and familiarity with a common tongue. Within the last 150 years, the conquests of the Roman arms had, as if miraculously, brought the Mediterranean world into the unity of a common political system. There had never been more facility for travel and for the exchange of thought, more freedom from hostile molestation. And through this world of Greek speech and Greek culture, of Roman roads and Roman institutions, the Jewish people, hitherto so stay at home, so conservative, had pushed forward its outposts, little colonies in Rome, in Alexandria, in Ephesus, in Corinth, ready to act as centers for the propagation of a Jewish message. Was it too much to say, in that age, that the fields were already white to the harvest? Let us add, at the risk of seeming fanciful, that something of this atmosphere of expectancy which reigned among the Jewish people had found its way into Gentile utterances, too. After 50 years of continuous civil discord, even the urbane Horace could feel the need of national regeneration, and sigh for a Scythian caravan, or a cruise to the islands of the blessed, could ask what messenger Jupiter would send to expiate the world's crimes, and Virgil, whatever the source of his inspiration, could break out into anticipations of a golden age which seemed to reflect not only the thought, but the language of Hebrew prophecy. These straws floating on the surface of polite literature indicate, surely, deeper currents of popular feeling underneath. Such considerations as the foregoing will carry more weight with some minds than with others. I have only been at pains to write this crude frontispiece to the story of the Christian revelation, because it does provide a sort of answer to a foolish but common objection which is sometimes raised against the truth of Christianity. Why should we be expected to pay so much attention, it is urged, to a particular set of events which happened at one particular moment of history, in one particular corner of the ancient world, as if there was something provincial about the idea of God revealing himself at one time instead of another, in one place instead of another. Perhaps it will be a plaster for the irritation these scruples set up, to fall back upon the reflections I have hereto said, namely, that although Palestine was a small country, and a provincial country, its religious history would, even apart from any Christian considerations, be something phenomenal among religious histories, and that the moment at which we claim the whole course of the world was changed was a moment which might well have been selected, or rather ordained, providentially. So full was it of conscious need and of practical opportunity. Nor need our religion be ashamed, in spite of modern sneers, of having taken root first in the seed ground of Judaism. If the Christian religion could be proved an imposture, we should have to admit that, of all the great religions in the world, Judaism was the purest in its method of worship, and the truest in its theological principles. A consideration which lends force to that pious Catholic belief, according to which Israel, as a nation, before the last act closes on the world's drama, is to be convinced at last of its old blindness, and brought into the fuller illumination of the Catholic Church. And notes. 1. Because he hath therefore scattered you among the Gentiles, who know not him, that you may declare his wonderful works, and make them know that there is no other Almighty God beside him. 7. The Christian Evidences. In the last chapter, I invited my reader to put his hand across the page, so to speak, and leave out of sight all that has happened since the beginning of the Christian era, to treat the year 1 BC as if it were the limit of his historical knowledge. I will now ask him, if I may pursue the same metaphor, to take his hand away, all except the top finger, to blot out from memory all that he knows of what happened between 1 BC and 80, 100, and to look with fresh eyes at the literature of the period which immediately follows the 12 Caesars, the literature, roughly speaking, that dates between 80, 90 and 120. You find the world still pagan. The same tradition of Greco-Roman culture persists, not menaced hitherto by grave corruption within, or formidable competition from without. Meanwhile, the Jewish race has disappeared from view, for the time being, as completely as it has ever disappeared in history. Jerusalem has been sacked, not one stone left on another, and with the loss of its nerve center the active life of Judaism seems temporarily suspended. The Roman satirist only connects it with the soothsayers who practiced upon the fashionable superstitions of the day. At the same time, in Bithynia, a province very far distant from Judea, a Roman governor, with great conscientiousness and some mildness of disposition, the younger Pliny, is becoming exercised over a pressing imperial problem. He writes to the Emperor Trajan to know if he has been right in the policy which he has adopted towards the troublesome sect of the Christians. There is no reason to think that the difficulty was merely local, that Bithynia was more infested with Christians than other provinces in the Hellenized portion of the Roman world. We have no statistics, but it is evident that the criminals in question were sufficiently numerous. Both Pliny and Trajan are anxious to discourage the activities of the informer, a sure sign that you are afraid of learning the true strength of your adversaries, and not a few, it would appear, of the accused renounce their opinions under the threat of punishment. The movement, therefore, was already sufficiently fashionable to be attracting half-hearted supporters. Pliny has heard various tales to the discredit of these strange votaries, tales of incestuous marriages, and of child-eating, but he confesses that in all his inquiries he has found no evidence to support such charges,